Yeah, you had temperate plants that have been found in the North Polar regions, which shows how there was a great change in conditions during all these geological periods. There were almost all the modern insects that developed by this time. The dinosaurs and other great reptiles which had dominated in the Cretaceous period had died out, become extinct. There were large flightless birds with strong legs in North America, probably waders. In fact, the Tertiary period, era rather, was the age of mammals. During the Paleocene, which is an important period of transition between the Cretaceous and the Eocene, mammals rapidly attained dominance on the land. The most primitive mammals were small, five-toed creatures with tiny brains and low-crowned teeth suitable for eating soft plants or insects. And in these times, these early types were evolving into a greater variety of animals. Bodies and brains have increased in size, and teeth and limbs adapted to many different modes of life. Now, all the main groups of placental mammals, including rodents and insectivores, primates, carnivores, and ungulates, or hoofed animals, and I've got to remember that primates include mankind, and we'll deal with that when we come to the, if we've got time, the second half of this talk on the emergence of the primate line, hominid line. There were pouch mammals, possums, and they existed in these times. The most numerous, of course, of animals were the herbivorous hoofed animals living in herds. A lot of aberrant types, which I'm not going to go into, but you can ask questions on afterwards if you care to. But there were elephants, rhinoceroses, horses, cattle, and pigs. These are all had all appeared. Elephants originated in Africa. A late Eocene elephant, for example, was found in the Fayum of Egypt, which is the swamp area of Egypt, and that was about the size of a tapir, had no trunk. Horses evolved in North America, and at different times they migrated into the Old World. And one of the earliest types, Eohippus, Hyracotherium, the name means dawn horse, that had arrived in Europe before the laying down of the London claims, and it was no bigger than a fox terrier, very, very small, and had four-toed front feet suited to marshy ground and teeth suited to browsing. And there were also carnivores, flesh-eating creatures with teeth specialized for cutting and tearing. Now, in this era, in this period, you had the early primates, and these were derived from shrew-like insectivores, and we'll go more into that when we come to the second part. And these became quite widespread in Eocene times. You had also primitive monkeys and gibbon-like forms, which had appeared, so that this was a very, very important period as far as mankind is concerned, because it was in the Eocene times that the primates really started to develop. The next period is the Oligocene period, so-called from two Greek words meaning recent forms of life, duration 15 million years, from 40 to 25 million years ago. Same similar conditions as the Eocene, as far as geographical conditions are concerned. There were one or two outstanding features. you had formed in this period. Mountains like the Alps were raised up in this period, and the Himalayas. There were warm temperate conditions, very widespread, and the distribution of animals and plants, such as crocodiles, and there were palms, they became more restricted, showing that parts of the continents were affected by a cooler climate. Life in the sea, much like the previous period. Modern types of marine crustaceans, including crabs. Life on the land, the grassland increased, torrents dwindled, swamps. You had brown coal being formed, lignite, as I said earlier. Insects in this period were snails, and freshwater mussels were widespread and abundant. Vertebrates, the mammals dominated in the Eocene, had now largely been replaced by others, more ancestral to modern types. Bats, very abundant, and it was their droppings of these abundant bats that contributed to the formation of phosphate deposits, such as those in the south of France. You had Oligocene elephants. They were small with short trunks. Odd-toed ungulates. Ungulates, of course, are hoofed animals. The central toe being the largest, and the others, the central toe bore most of the weight. You had three-toed horses and so on. And a lot of other animals, which I'm not going to go into. One, of course, was the Paleotherium, and this was the animal that Cuvier, who was a very noted French paleontologist of the early 19th century, reconstructed from a few bones which were found in the Paris gypsum deposits, if that's of any interest. Now, in this period also, you had the primates, as I said earlier. You had in Africa a gibbon-like primate, which will feature to a much greater extent later on, called Propliopithecus, related to the ancestors of the higher apes and mankind. The next period is the Miocene period. Miocene means less recent. There were fewer modern types of animals in the succeeding period. Duration 13 million years, from 25 to 12 million years ago. There were not, as I said before, the events which led up to the formation of the Alps and the Himalayas. There were powerful movement of the Earth's crust, squeezed the sedimentary strata occupying the ancient trough of the Tethyan Ocean into mountains. There were changes in the boundaries of the seas. Mediterranean, an almost completely landlocked sea, that's what it became. The uplift of the Alps and the Himalayas and other mountain ranges intensified. And there were climatic changes. Subtropical gave place to temperate climate. And life in the sea, nummulites had died out. There were large protozoan rhizopods flourished in the open seas, bony fishes, great variety of forms, life on the land, vegetation, bulrushes, woodlands with beech trees, poplars and shrubs, prairie grasses. Invertebrates were beetles, bugs and dragonflies, etc. Vertebrates, one in particular, skeletons of a Miocene amphibian, the salamander, Andreas Schweitzeri, or whatever it was, I can't pronounce it, it's such a peculiar name. But however, it was found in Switzerland in a peculiar deposit, and it was described as that of a man drowned in the flood. Homo diluvii testis. Man as witness to the flood. I think I mentioned earlier on in our earlier talks In the early history of paleontology, you had all kinds of peculiar ideas, or at least the scientists or so-called scientists of the time had peculiar ideas. And one of them was, of course, that this persistence upon the floods, and this was one of the instances where they called this salamander a man, saying that, of course, it was a skeleton from the flood. Miocene horses, about the size of Shetland ponies, and the commonest carnivores in Miocene times were small saber-toothed tigers. Primates were becoming diverse, particularly in Central Africa. They included primitive anthropoid apes, known as proconsul, and some of these early apes migrated into Asia and Europe during Miocene times. Dryopithecus, a gibbon-like ape. Pliopithecus was a fairly common in the forests of southern Europe in the latter part of the period. Now, all these apes, Miocene apes, we will deal with to a much greater extent, because when we deal with the evolution of the primates and mankind, they are very, very important. Now, I don't know whether it's necessary we can skip a bit of this. The next period is the Pliocene. Not much to report from that. At least I'm not going to report it. Well, in the Pliocene, of course, you had primates developing to a greater extent, and you had the horses, Hipparion, and migrated from North America into Asia. But we now come to the what is probably the most important period as far as evolution in relation to socialism is concerned, and that is the Quaternary. Now, the Quaternary was once considered to be the fourth era of life, and it's divided into the Pleistocene period, which includes the Great Ice Age, and the Holocene, or so-called post-glacial period, in which we are now living. The term Pleistocene means most recent. Holocene means wholly recent. And both terms are derived from the Greek. The geographical conditions during the Pleistocene period, you had ice sheets and glaciers developed in the north of Europe and America, in the Antarctic and the high mountains, such as the Alps and the Himalayas. And from time to time, warmer conditions returned and the ice was reduced in extent. The Pleistocene can be divided into four glacial and three interglacial periods. Now, during the glacial periods, the sea level was lower and Britain was joined to the continent. During interglacial periods, the sea level, of course, was higher than it is at the present, and these changes in level are indicated by raised beaches, which with drowned valleys and submerged forest, which come to light now and again. In Europe and North America, during Pleistocene times, land masses covered by ice were pressed down under its weight. And as the ice melted away, a slow recovery took place, and this recovery, as a matter of fact, is still continuing, according to recent reports, in Scandinavia. In some parts of which the land is rising at the rate of a centimetre in a year. Not very spectacular, but of course it's happening. There were important movements and volcanic activity along part of the zigzag line of breaks in the earth crust which forms the Great Rift Valley. Very, very interesting study, the Great Rift Valley, from many points of view, which we might go into later at another talk. This extends from Palestine in the north to Rhodesia in the south. The ice sheets were fringed by a wide belt of tundra, or partly frozen ground, which was barren of trees except for dwarf birches and Arctic willows. And the melting ice in the summer deposited great quantities of gravel, sand and clay in the tundra. And during the dry seasons, the finer material was carried by strong winds and deposited as a fine dust called loess. Now, you've heard about loess in China. The dust, which is very, very fertile, very good. This is the dust that, which was carried from the tundra of that period. With the onset of warmer conditions, which brought about the last retreat of the ice, forests spread over the formerly glaciated parts of Europe, and it's been estimated that by counting the number of layers of mud, which are called varves, deposited by glacial meltwaters during the period of the ice, the dates can be estimated. The cause of the Pleistocene Ice Age is uncertain. As you know, there's a hell of a lot of speculation about it, and there's been a lot of discussion in modern times quite recently. But it's been suggested that one factor may have been exceptional sunspot activity, which increased the snowfall in high latitudes and at high altitudes, and the rainfall in tropical regions, because in glaciated periods, the tropics didn't experience ice or glaciers, but they experienced very, very wet conditions in line with the glaciations in the north. In the tropical zone, evidence of an alternation of pluvial or wetter and interpluvial, drier periods, which, as I said, corresponded to glacial and interglacial periods in Europe. The existence of ice in the polar regions at the present day is abnormal, apparently, according to the investigation of this phenomenon. And it's uncertain whether in the course of the next 10 or 20,000 years all polar and Arctic ice caps will disappear, or whether it will become more extensive and parts of the northern hemisphere be once again covered by ice. A lot of speculation. Some scientists are saying that we are now beginning to embark upon another ice age. Whatever truth there is in that, I don't know, but the ice ages have occurred in this period. I'm not going to say much about the marine life in this period. There are a number of changes. Birds in the Pleistocene were mainly of modern type. Some, like the great auk, were now extinct. The land mammals, this greatly affected the distribution of these animals, particularly in the northern hemisphere. Most of the present-day species came into existence during this period. They were differently distributed. For example, during the last glaciation, reindeer, Arctic fox, and the steep marmot ranged as far south as southern England. Apparently, steep and tundra conditions prevailed at that time. But in the interglacial periods, hippopotamuses lived in the Thames and lions ranged as far north as Yorkshire. A spotted hyena, too, lived in England during Pleistocene times because its bones and teeth, together with that of its prey, are often found in caves. And other animals developed special adaptations to the harsh climate of the Ice Age. Among them, of course, were the woolly rhinoceros and the mammoth. Heard a lot recently about the hairy elephant, hairy mammoth. These are special adaptations from that period. There were lots of other aspects which I'm not going to go into, only to say that the appearance of true elephants and horses, the species equus and oxen, marked the beginning of Pleistocene. These were to be found in England, apparently. Elephants and so on. Mammoths. Now, what is more important to us, that nearly 3 million years ago, at the beginning of the Pleistocene, there appeared the ape-like Australopithecus, which means southern ape. And I'll have a lot more to say about this later on. Had developed probably the first real tool using animal, originated in Africa, and they'd spread by the middle of the Pleistocene, they'd spread widely over the old world. There were other Australopithecus kinds of species which are regarded as the same genus but have been given different names. Among these, in Java, the Java man and the Heidelberg, Neanderthal, Rhodesian and Swanscombe man, and the skeletal remains are exceedingly rare. These were all found in the Pleistocene period, and the cavemen, so-called, of the late Pleistocene times, Cro-Magnon man, and related races of modern type. These all evolved during Pleistocene times. The Holocene, which is the period that we are now in, began about 10,000 BC, consequent upon the disappearance of the glacial conditions. Well, I think that's all we need to say, and I think that's more than enough to say about the succession of life in geological times. And I'm glad we've dispensed with it, because although it's important from the point of view of understanding in the proper perspective the kind of arguments that we were dealing with and the way to deal with them, appreciation of the time factor involved, it's a bit tedious, to say the least. But the next section, if we've got time, and I could probably deal with that just as rapidly, is the history of the primates and the emergence of the hominid line. So let us, unless you want to ask any questions about this other part of the talk, let us deal with that.
I think as I see it, that if we have questions on the first part, as it's about coming up to 9:45 now, I was wondering if we can postpone the...
Well, you see, I knew it would take quite a time. I didn't anticipate, as a matter of fact, that we would get through it. I've sort of scarpered through it very superficially. And this is because of the time factor. But having got rid of that, when, for example, we are talking about the theory of evolution, and of course I've not mentioned any of the mechanism of natural selection. I'll deal with that in talk 4 when I deal with Darwin and Wallace and the theory of natural selection, which of course includes a consideration of genetics. I thought it would be best to give you the rough facts first. Now, we've bitten off quite a bit. The reason why I was going to deal in this talk with the history of the primates and the emergence of the hominid line is that the development of man is in really two parts. The first part shows the development of the primates. And there are two distinct sections, because the primates are divided into the prosimiae, that are animals like tree shrews, lemurs, lorises, and tarsiers, which, although were ancestral to anthropoid apes, were separated as quite different. So that the emergence of the hominid line is consequent upon an understanding of how the unspecialized ape-like creatures existing at the during the Pleistocene, primates that were further evolution of the more primitive primates, and how they developed into hominids, and the factors that separate a hominid from the lower primates. And this is a very, very important factor. Australopithecus, when it was discovered by Raymond Dart, there's a lot of controversy about this that I'll deal with later, which is very, very essential in relation to the modern ethologists. But Australopithecus, it was so named Southern Ape because there was a lot of discussion about whether it could be recalled hominid or not. Now, Australopithecus is the end product, as it were, of the hominid apes like Priapopithecus and Oreopithecus that preceded the hominid line. And from that period onwards, when Australopithecus emerged, you had the other hominid examples like Java man, Peking man, Rhodesian man, and finally, of course, you had what is called modern man about 50,000 years ago. So really it's in two sections. So if you like, this section dealing with the emergence of the hominid line from the history of the primates can be tacked on to the other consideration, which is the evolution of mankind and the emergence of Homo sapiens.
Mm.
Well, those two can go together, but the reason why I wanted to deal with that one separate is because you can't really skate over the consideration of the evolution of mankind and the emergence of Homo sapiens in exactly the same way as you can deal with the other sections, because as important as it is to get a rough idea of what we're talking about overall, as we progress, it becomes more involved and much more precise.
Mm.
It's necessary to become much more precise than we've been so far.
Mm. So, I think, if it is possible to deal with those,
right? So, if you want to deal with the primate, the history of the primates, and the emergence of the hominid line, that will be the title in accord with the evolution of mankind and the emergence of Homo sapiens. That will be one talk.
Which will be the next one.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, are there any questions?
Is there anything?
Well, there's only one thing here, particularly I would like, you know. We were talking about the Permian era, you know, time.
The what area?
The Permian era.
Permian era, the Permian period.
Period. Do you know the climates of volcanic matter? What ratio, you know, was it, you know, in comparison to what we have? You know, and you say that it was a. Do you have an idea?
Well, as far as I can gather, it was even greater than what. You know, it's very spasmodic today, but in that period, it seemed to be very generalized. There was a general outpouring of these of this lava and so on.
That's all.
Yeah. Well,
any other immediate questions, Dylan?
Yes. About the back deposit in the south of France, there's all those seabirds. Deposits off Chile and also Peru, those Guarano Islands.
Yeah, well, they are more recent. They've been deposited in this period, and they were accumulated because of isolation, and they more or less solidified until somebody got the idea of using them for fertilizer. Then they became a commercial proposition. But the deposits in France were were deposits, the geological deposits, which sunk down and became a geological strata, as it were, underneath the earth, as do quite a lot of these other stratas. You see, you've got to remember that there were changes going on all the time. Some of the sediments that were laid down in shallow seas and became compressed, and for example, chalk, which was laid down in a shallow sea in the Cretaceous period, was raised up because of other conditions in the form of cliffs, as the cliffs of Dover, for example. Sedimentary rocks form the Himalayas and the Alps. At one time, they were more or less flat expanses of Earth. The earthquake conditions, which and the folding of the Earth's crust, which gave rise to the Alps and the Himalayas, means that, of course, you find sediments on the top of the mountains, which were, first of all, deposited in seas. This was one of the reasons why, when seashells were found at the top of the Himalayas and the Alps, that the theorists for the diluvian concept about the Great Flood maintained that they got there because the flood waters had carried them there. As it happens, of course, this was shattered by Leonardo da Vinci. As I said in my first talk, Leonardo da Vinci was one of the first to recognize what actually had been taking place in relation to fossilized forms. He realized that it wasn't the result of flood. It was the results of land, first of all, being submerged in a sea and then being thrown up over millions of years. See, I mean, you're dealing 4,500 million years, 4,000 million years of which is the Precambrian period, and even in the 600 million years, you've got an enormous period of time. You see, as a matter of fact, of course, the whole theory of evolution, as formulated by Darwin and Watt Wallace, depends upon an enormous period of time, much greater than the 600 million years. That's one of the reasons why Darwin found it difficult to push his idea in relation to the apparent non-existence of fossils in the Precambrian era. They've since been discovered, which substantiates his theory.
Well, now this is the official time when generally we have to move out about 10 to 10 now. I think we can sort of I could either suggest if anyone has any sort of particular question. Well, there are three possibilities. Put it this way: either you could take up a question with Harry afterwards, I'm sure he'd be pleased to answer. Or alternatively, if you have a particular question that you think would be good for discussion, you could perhaps write it down and either give it to me or bring it along in 3 weeks' time when the third of these classes takes place, and we could then perhaps open up a discussion and provide time for that. Or thirdly, if anyone has anything they sort of desperately want to say at the moment, we could do. But generally speaking, I think we ought to move out.
Yeah, I'm sorry I've taken so long.
No, it's necessary to deal with things in depth. Yes.
I think it should be discussed about the work of Humboldt.
The what?
Alexander Humboldt.
Humboldt. Yeah.
But before Darwin, he did a lot of work in geographical work.
Yeah, that's coming up in the fourth talk on Darwin. Yeah. So we'll be able to raise those things there. If anyone has any particular point for discussion they want to raise, if you sort of let me know it, I can sort of remind Harry in 3 weeks' time, and we can make sure that we provide time to have discussion on it. But if anyone has any question they want, I would say take it up with Harry now, or if you think it's of use for other people, then deal with them. But obviously, with these talks, as everyone appreciates, the main objective, the first objective, is to provide introductory material, and therefore the speaker's got to be given more time than he would in a usual propaganda lecture. So there's certainly nothing wrong at all with the fact that most of the time's been taken up this evening with the talk, which I'm sure everyone will agree is very informative. As a pianist at Hen and Chickens has told me that he's especially learnt to play Burlington Bertie from Bow for the sake of the speaker, I think that the least we can do is adjourn.